Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome again to Beyond the Cover. I'm your host, John Robb, and I'm with my co-host, Jeff Mayers. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing fantastic. How you doing?
Fabulous. I feel much better this week. I'm doing good. I'm not
good.
Sick anymore. And so we've decided that we talk too much, and we're not going to talk anymore this show. We're going to have three interviews from Thriller Fest: Hank Phillippe Ryan, Jamie Frappoletti, and then Robert Wilson. And they're going to be back to back to back, and we're just going to come on at the end, and we'll say goodbye, and that'll be it. What do you think about that? It's going to be a show where we don't talk.
I think a lot of people will appreciate that.
I think they will. So you know what? Let's start it right now. Here we go. Hank Phillippe
right.
Ryan from Thriller Fest, everybody. That's it.
So Jeff and I are here again at Thriller Fest with
Howdy.
Hank Phillippe Ryan. Hank,
hey.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
So, first question we've been asking all the authors is, how special and what does Thriller Fest mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. I remember the first time I came to Thriller Fest, which I can't even remember how long ago that was. It was my first book, and I was so excited, and I walked into the hotel, and it was just teeming with every famous author I could ever imagine. And I was a little overwhelmed. I thought, how am I supposed to make myself known in this room full of people who are brilliant and successful and powerful, and this, you know, I felt like the new kid, like absolutely a new kid. And I think people who are coming to Thriller Fest for the first time need to sort of embrace that that is hilarious, that they're lucky to be in this group, they're lucky to share the joy of having written a book or learning how to write a book, and that right here in this one little hotel is everything they could ever know. It is just a glorious supermarket full of information and knowledge and experience and genuine affection. I mean, people, my advice would be, don't be afraid to talk to someone, don't be afraid to go up to someone, don't be afraid to connect with your favorite author, you know, obviously in a respectful, polite way. And with,
well,
you, with and yeah, you're a problem. Jeff, you're a problem. That's everybody talks about it. And
that's why we have them behind the screen, people.
I wonder why.
That's why we do that.
The other thing is that when you're writing, you are so alone. You're in your little office or wherever you write by yourself, and you think, I'm the only one who feels this way. I'm the only one who's having trouble. I'm the only one who doesn't know what I'm doing. And you come to a place like this, and you realize everybody has the same feeling. So we write alone, but coming to a conference like this proves we're not alone. So you can turn to anybody, from the best-selling author to the newbiest of newbie who is sitting by you, and talk about anything. You know, this is, it's just a wonderful opportunity to, all you have to do is say to a new person, what are you working on? How are you? Where are you from? And boom, you're in a conversation. So it's no holds barred, and it's quite marvelous. It can be a little overwhelming,
yes,
you know?
That's what I was gonna, yeah.
And I do think, just don't be put off by that. You know, again, think you're not the only one who feels overwhelmed. Everybody feels overwhelmed. And just go for it. You know, just you'll have a, I promise you, and I'd love your listeners to email me and tell me what it is, because everyone will has one fabulous, memorable experience every Thriller Fest. There's always this gem of a gorgeous story that they'll take home.
I completely agree with that. I'm curious, because I have a problem with this sometimes. You talk about the solitary aspect of writing, but then you come to a place like this here, and then you're sociable all of a sudden. Can you talk a bit about that switch?
somebody once told me that one of the situations that occurs at these conventions is that you have 2,000 people who'd rather be by themselves, all forced to be in a place where they have to talk to each other. You know, and so everyone feels the same. Everybody's curious. Everyone's interested. Everybody's, you know, frankly, kind of comparing what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get the, forgive me for this, but you kind of get the author zeitgeist. So even though we are, I mean, I'm such a, if I say introvert, I know, Jeff, you're going to laugh, but totally true. If someone said, you want to go to a party or do you want to stay home? I'm like, I guess I'd rather stay home. And I bet so many people at this convention feel just the same way. But here we all are together. Here we are. And it just doesn't matter for one fabulous weekend. You know, we all get to talk about books and thrillers and writing and experience and fears and loves, and it's great.
Now, you go to many different conferences, of course, not just Thriller Fest, but there's several that go on, and there's almost one a month. It seems like you have the one in BoucherCon and Killer Nashville and Malice and Left Coast Crime. How is this one different? Because some of those seem to be more fan. This is a little bit more, I guess, professional. Because you say, how is it different for you when you come into here?
I think Thriller Fest is glittery. I think, you know, Thriller Fest is sort of, it always feels very polished. And you're exactly right about professional. I mean, these are the pros who are here. And these are the thriller writers. You know, these are the fast-paced, page-turning, suspense-writing men and women who know what they're doing and have experience and have information and have a goal. It moves. It's very New York. I mean, this conference is very New York. It moves fast, and I think that's how it's different. Some, you know, a smaller writers' conference may be more laid back or traditional or a little quieter. I mean, I've been to conferences where the bar is empty at 10.
Not here.
I don't think it ever empties here.
I agree.
People just come down and go to panels at 8 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and by late Sunday afternoon, there are a lot of groggy-looking people. But that's part of the thing. I mean, I think it's fun. It's fast-paced. It's a big deal. Thriller Fest is big, don't you think?
Yeah.
I would agree for sure. I have to ask about the new book because I haven't seen a galley yet. So
they just arrived on my doorstep.
Okay. Well, it comes out in October. Like, I think it's the 12th or 15th, right around there.
Yeah, it's the 20th.
The 20th, okay.
And thank you for making me say that. That's great.
Yes.
October 20th. It's called What You See. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited about it. I got a call from Lisa Unger, who said, I couldn't put it down. So that's a high accolade.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about all the surveillance, it's the next Jane Ryland novel.
Number four. So people know.
Yeah, you can read them
I
in any
Jane.
Order.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. She's a reporter in Boston.
Not that you know anything about that.
No.
Yeah. Well, you went on a limb with that one.
I did. I scraped the bottom.
That's a lot of research.
Exactly. Well, people say to me, do you do a lot of research for your Jane Ryland books? And I say, I've been doing research for 40 years. I got this Boston investigative reporter thing down pat. So you can read them in any order. It's a series of standalones.
Mm-hmm.
Book four, the fourth Jane book, is called What You See. It's about, you know, all the surveillance that is everywhere these days. Everywhere we go, someone is taking our picture in this hotel. I'm sure we're on surveillance video. Hello. All the time. Certainly in the street, certainly in restaurants, certainly in stores, certainly in hotels, certainly everywhere there's cameras. And somebody is recording exactly where we are and what we're doing all the time. And we know this. We've seen the Ray Rice videos, and we see the videos of the actor trashing the hotel room.
And just the new Florida State quarterback, if you haven't seen that one, just at a bar, a little dinky thing in a bar, the Florida State quarterback literally just punched this girl right on camera, and of course they dismissed him. But, I mean, Ray Rice was at least an elevator that you would know that there's a camera. This, it's like you would have no idea there would even be a camera there.
What about Ariana Grande and the licking the donuts? I mean,
right.
I'm sorry, I hope we're not talking about that anymore. But
thanks for joining us today.
And then we're done. But the thing that got me thinking about those surveillance cameras when it comes to writing a great thriller and a page-turning story is that what about you and me and you and everyone in your family, and we're all on video too, and all that video is someplace, and someone has access to all of it. And what might somebody do with that? You know, what could somebody do if they looked at it and scoped it out and figured out who was who and who was where and what they were doing and when they shouldn't have been there? Not famous people, but just you and me. And what might they do with some of that information? And that's what You See is about.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of tyranny of constant surveillance. What we give up, you know, we give up our privacy, and sometimes it solves crimes, and that's the Jake part. The other main character in the Jane Ryland books is Jake Brogan, who's a Boston police detective. And he...
Better put them together, I won't just say it.
You know, Jake and Jane are madly in love with each other, but they can't be together. She's a reporter, and he's a source, and so never the twain shall meet, at least by book four. And... Jake, oh, spoiler alert. Although there's something unusual that happened, so you'll love it, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
Jake is called to the scene of a stabbing, a murder, in the middle of Curly Park, which is right outside Quincy Market, Faneuil Hall in Boston, a big tourist attraction in Boston. It's noon. It's almost July 4th. Someone is stabbed to death right in broad daylight in the midst of the public. And, of course, the tourists are all taking pictures of it. So there are pictures of the murder, and the point of what you see is you think, well, the cops will be able to solve this. There are pictures of the guy holding the knife in the guy's back, in the victim's back. But what you see is not always the truth. And so even though with the pictures of a murder, Jake has to figure out what really happened and what's really behind those pictures and how... Even with surveillance and even with the photograph, you can't really know the truth without going deeper than that.
Yeah, I would think that if somebody was following me, they'd be like, "Well, we don't have to identity theft him because he is boring." But you know what you touch on is something very, and it's almost when you think about it, it can be very scary, because. There's eyes everywhere. You're being followed everywhere. I mean, just last night, you know, there was a picture of me and Reavers Wortham. We're just joking around. He gets me today and he goes, "Someone put it on Facebook."
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And so it doesn't take that long. And then once it's out there, even if you delete it, someone could have grabbed it and then it's gone. And I don't think people realize that. So when you're exploring those things with Jane and your character, do you find some disturbing facts that you're like, "I didn't even know this existed, and this really disturbs me"?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. I've been a reporter for 40 years. I'm still on the air at the NBC affiliate in Boston. And one of the stories I did was about, it was some like minor story about jaywalking in Boston. When I go to other cities, people don't jaywalk. But in Boston, you just walk wherever you want to go. And the cars have to stop, and they sometimes do and sometimes don't. So City Hall put up surveillance cameras at the intersections to watch for jaywalkers and to watch for traffic jams, and the traffic people use them to adjust the lights make the lights be red or green,
right,
and so they don't have traffic jams. So I go into this big surveillance room at City Hall to do a story about this, and I see this bank of many monitors on the wall. And there's surveillance cameras of everywhere. I mean, I can see down in Curly Park. I can see Quincy Market. I can see the hotel. I can see Channel 7. I can see the intersection of Congress Street and North Street. And I mean, I can see this. And I said, you know, do lawyers ever subpoena this video? You know, if there was a traffic accident, if there was a drunk driving thing, if there was some sort of an incident, do lawyers ever subpoena the video that from these? And where do you keep that? And how do you keep it? And how long do you keep it? And they said, "Oh, no, we don't keep it. We just see it live, but it's not recorded.
Okay.
So I thought, and so, you know, crime fiction author me, I'm like, "Oh, right, you don't record it." And that's where that story came from.
Okay.
That's where that story came from. What could happen to that video and what they see from City Hall. And then Jake, the detective, realizes that this is what they're doing. So instead of going on a stakeout, I'm not giving too much away. Instead of going on a stakeout, he says, "I'm going to go up into the City Hall surveillance room and watch from there." And someone says, "You need a warrant to look at their computers." And he's like, "No, I don't. I'm just looking out a window. It's just a really, really good window."
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. So it's that line between privacy and the ubiquity of surveillance cameras and what someone might do with that, and what you might see. And now what's changed me is everywhere I go, I look to see if there's a camera.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go.
All these traffic cameras.
And they're all, you see those little white things with the little lenses, everywhere. I mean, they're seeing us all the time. I love that. So from the standpoint of crime fiction, how suspenseful is that?
Built-in
plot. Someone is watching you all the time. And who might use that? Who might use the knowledge that someone is watching you all the time on both sides of the camera?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the scary part.
Well, they even talk about those video game systems that, you know, they scan your body.
The
Kinect. That supposedly they, because those are cameras, they're looking at you.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. About all that stuff.
I'm sorry, I've made it worse now, but I think it is worse. I think it is worse.
Well, I guess do you think we, with all the surveillance, are safer as a result, or are we even less safe?
Oh, good question. I mean, I just don't know. I wish there was an easy answer to that. I think we're safer in some ways. They caught the marathon bombers
in Boston
from the video from Lord and Taylor or something like that. So certainly it's helpful in law enforcement. Certainly it's a deterrent unless you're drunk or, you know, completely unsure of your circumstances. You would think, I'm not going to do whatever it is because, I mean, bank robbers you see all the time get caught. But if someone said, do you want to take it all away, it would be tempting to take it all away. What do you think?
You know, I guess I'm on the fence because I've always, and I see the shows, and I'm always one of those people when they say, well, I want to search your bag. And I'm like, well, no, you need a warrant. Well, if you have nothing to hide, why can't I look? It's like, because that's my right. And, you know, and I always crack up when I watch cops and they pull somebody over for speeding and they said, so where are you going? And I'm on the TV saying, that's none of your business where I'm going. If you pulled me over, then just tell me that I did something. But then they're like, well, where are you going? Well, what are you doing? It's like, well, that's none of your business.
It's an interesting
And I don't understand. And so I always yell at the TV.
Yelling at the TV is a classic American thing
that
we all do. We all yell at the TV, thank goodness, all the time. Yeah, but I mean, that's one of the difficulties of our complicated life today
is
balancing our need for security versus our need to protect our rights and our privacy. And, you know, this is a whole long conversation that I love that we're having.
It is,
Because if we can get people to think about it, they can make their own decision about it, but at least they can be aware of their rights and aware of the scrutiny mm-hmm. that they're under all the time, and they can just stop licking donuts. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I went to the Statue of Liberty yesterday and went through all the security screening, and like, okay, you know, it's like a long way to go through. You know, you have to take your belt off and all this other stuff, and I think, you know, good grief, next thing you know, I'm going to have to come in completely naked or something. And you do that, and then we decided to go to the new One World Trade Center, and went through the whole procedure again. I'm thinking, I just did this over here. Why don't you just call them?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's funny, but it is. Things have really changed.
They have.
We have grown up in a time of big changes.
Yeah,
sure.
So, I mean, that's what the book is about.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it, honestly.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. To be able to go on tour, I'll be on tour this fall. That'll be
great.
Truth be told, the previous book won the Agatha for Best Mystery. It was a Library Journal. Thank you. Best book of 2014. So this is, you know, the Other Woman won the Mary Higgins Clark Award. The Wrong Girl won the Agatha. And then Truth Be Told won the next year's Agatha. So I'm very excited to see the response to what you see. You know, after 35 years as a television reporter to start writing
mm-hmm.
fiction, you know, I got to make stuff up for the first time. It's exciting. It's this whole second chapter of my life has been quite amazing.
Well, we know you have to go, so why don't you just finish up and tell everybody where they can find you, your website, social media, if you want to, and let everybody know.
And tell them my password, right?
And you know, anything you'd like to know.
Exactly. I cleverly named my website HankPhilippiRyan.com. And you can find me on Facebook at HankPhilippiRyan. Please do, you know, and on Twitter at HankPRyan. I love social media. I'm on it ridiculously mm-hmm. lots, and so much fun to meet people here at Thriller Fest.
Yeah.
I've had people come up to me and say, you know, how are the ducks, you know, or how's your husband? I have ducks in my backyard in the pool that come every spring and leave in the summer, my mallards. But people know about it. People know me and know about my life, and I embrace that totally. And I see them here at Thriller Fest,
that's
and I say, you know, how's the dog? Did your daughter graduate from college? And I think, and then I realize, oh my goodness, I've never seen this person in my life, and you know, and I know them totally. So I embrace that. It's just great.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for sitting down with us for a couple minutes. It was wonderful.
My pleasure. Have a great time at Thriller Fest.
Okay. So we're here with Jamie Frevoletti at Thriller Fest. Jamie, thanks so much. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm having a great time.
Good. Now, you did a craft fest morning for Lorenzo. I can never pronounce his last name.
Cascatia.
Yeah. And but you weren't supposed to. But you're always here at Thriller Fest. This is the 10th anniversary, so it's kind of a big deal with them. So what does Thriller Fest mean to you as an author?
Well, I was here at the very first Thriller Fest. I went to Arizona, and anyone who went there will know it was kind of magical. And so I've been at every Thriller Fest since. When I first started, I was unpublished, was looking for an agent. And I actually had been picked up from the slush pile, I think, two Thriller Fest later, and the agent was going to be here, and we had been talking about my manuscript, and then we were actually able to meet personally here, talk about things, and she ended up telling me if I made a couple of changes, she'd take the book. So Thriller Fest was kind of instrumental in getting me a face-to-face meeting with my agent.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've come every year because I always get a good tip. There's, even as a published writer now, I listen to people, and I always go away with some new insight into something.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because, I mean, in just in 10 years, look how fast you've come, and you still are learning. You're always constantly learning. So you find something from somebody, whether it's because Thriller Fest is broken up. You have Craft Fest, you have Thriller Fest, so you have something for everybody. And when a new author comes, like yourself, you know, 10 years ago, what were the expectations that you had going into it, and has it changed now that it's been 10 years and Thriller Fest has kind of changed?
Well, My first time I went was the very first time this organization had a conference, and I was excited because I was writing thrillers. And I thought it was finally a conference just for thriller writers that I could actually meet other people. I could make some networks and contact some networking within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly that. It's always been that. So I use the Thriller Fest conference for a one-stop shop. I can see I'm published by two people. I've been published by HarperCollins and Grand Central. So I have a lot of editors. I have a lot of, you know, publishers. And I can see everybody here. So for me, I try to come every year just to do my meet and greet with everybody. We kind of catch up. And then, as you say, I try to get here for Craft Fest so I can kind of peek in. And
mm-hmm.
either I teach a class now, or I try to listen to other people because I'm always learning. And one thing about Thriller Fest Conference is I think there are so many different tracks for so many different people that you can always find something.
And now that they have a pitch fest, that's something that they didn't have back when you started. So if you're an author and you were to see something like that, what advice would you give somebody to come in while they're pitching? Because you've had to pitch before, maybe not in a room for a bunch of people, but what's an advice that you would give a new author that is attending for Pitch Fest to try to become published?
Okay, I have had to pitch in a room. Before I
mm-hmm.
came to Thriller Fest, there was a small festival in Aurora, Illinois, of all places, and this is a
mm-hmm.
little shout-out to small festivals. If you can get to one in your town, do it. You'd always be surprised who you'll meet there. But they had a 90-second pitch. You had to stand up on stage, take a microphone. You had 60 seconds to pitch your book, the premise of your book. I would tell everybody listening that if they come here for that, try and shoot for that 60-second mark. Practice it in front of a mirror. I had a girlfriend with me at that conference. I ran in the back hallway, and she worked me through some of the. I had an idea that I thought was good, and we really tailored it down. And be prepared to give that 60-second pitch at Pitch Fest here. Now, I will be sitting at a table today. I guess they want me to listen to pitches, and I just love it because I, again, learn from that what's the highlight of your book and how can you pitch it verbally. I'm hoping to hit L.A. shortly, and I may have to pitch a teleplay.
Oh.
And if I pitch that, it's going to be the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Log line, what's the story about?
Yeah. Now let's get to your writing, because you said you have two publishers. For somebody that's kind of listening, they're like, why do you have two publishers? I mean, you know, how does that dynamic thing kind of work?
Yeah, clarify that. I'll say I have my own series, Running from the Devil, that was published by HarperCollins.
Mm-hmm.
And then while I was working on that series, the state of Robert Ludlum hired me to write not his Bourne series. He created Jason Bourne, but
mm-hmm.
His Covert One series. And so that's published by a different house. That's published by Grand Central. So, you know, it's been an interesting thing to see two different very large houses and how they approach publishing books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been only great for me because I can pick and see what I like and how things work. And I have to say,
I'm charmed to have such great, you know, professionals around me.
Now, were you shocked when they contacted you? Was it something out of the blue for the Ludlum Estate to kind of contact you and say, you know, did they read a certain book? Was it a certain character or something that got them onto you?
You know, I don't know the full details. It was a very secretive process, but they had picked 10 authors, some New York Times bestsellers, down to me. And at the time, I was just debut with Running from the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the mix. Then it got down to 3, and I still didn't know about it till it got down to 3. And I won the ITW Best Novel Award here, Best First Novel. And after I got off the stage, my agent took me in the bathroom. I was crying. My mascara was a mess. I was so excited.
That was your Oscar moment. You're like, yeah.
Moment. And she said, well, what do you think of Robert Ludlum? I'm like, I'm not thinking about him right now,
yeah.
You know. But she told me you're 1 of 3, and I didn't want to get your hopes up when you were 1 of 10, but now it's starting to look, you won this award.
Yeah.
A few months later, I won that Barry Award at Boucher Company,
right,
for the same novel, and they were in the bar. And the agent
came
up to me later, and she said, the State of Robert Ludlum, the representatives are in the bar, and they'd like to meet with you. So then I knew I was pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
They asked me to present something, an idea that I would do, and I did, and then I got the job.
Nice.
So it was very exciting.
So now, what are you working on now on your series?
Okay,
so
I just finished the Geneva Strategy, which came out February 3rd. That's Robert Ludlum's Covert One.
Okay.
So that came out February 3rd. So that's in the can. And usually those are written, I write 1 year for them, and then Kyle Mills picks up.
Okay.
He writes a year, then I write a year. So that's done. Emma, I have at 75,000 words. My Emma books run about 94,000, so I got 20,000 more to write, and I'm in meetings actually in about next month with regard to a distributor and a publisher for Emma. I'm moving Emma. Emma is going to move from HarperCollins.
Oh, okay.
But I also have a standalone I just wrote called Buddha's Black Soul. Ooh, maybe I shouldn't have given the title. Anyway, that might not be the title, guys, because it's
an arc. Wait till it hits the shelf.
It's in submission, but I just gave that to my agent, and HarperCollins is going to take a look. They may have first dibs to look at that one, but that one's going to go out wide.
That sounds
historical,
too.
We're going to submit. It's very interesting. It's not historical, but it's very interesting. So that one is on submission, so that means that my agent has it, and we'll see who decides they want to buy it.
Nice. And those are kind of the fun things, I guess, you're able to explore as a writer. You're able to kind of step outside and see different things and not kind of be stuck maybe into one thing where your publisher's like, no, you got to write 3 books on this character, and that's all we want.
Yeah.
So how is that exciting, and is it difficult to change tones and to do different things with the different books, you know, with the Ludlum series, your own series, and jumping around?
You know, honestly, in this day and age, and anyone who's listening, I would say, this day and age, authors write pretty much 2 books a year. You
can
be apparently not that way. I've never had the luxury of only writing 1 a year, but 2 books a year is a lot for anybody. So Ludlum, when Ludlum comes, I take it. And that's why Emma got kind of pushed put on the back burner for a minute, so I got Ludlum done, because
mm-hmm.
they're usually on a very strict schedule. Because of this other author,
right.
They don't, you know, I can't slow him down. And then I really think at this stage, it's nice. I know Emma so well, and I know the Covert One character so well. Those two are fine. I can write
mm-hmm.
those. Getting this third standalone, Buddha's Black Soul, done has been a challenge because it's brand new protagonist. And honestly, it's very exciting, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me a chance to kind of stretch again, which I need to have, I think, as a creative person. However, I got to fit that time in.
Yep.
So it's a little bit tight, and I'm not that fast of a writer. I write a book about every 9 months.
Okay.
And the slowest, the quickest I've ever written has been 4 months.
Wow.
That was an unusual circumstance where the book just was in my head. I just knew exactly what was going to happen. But that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
My usual is about 9 months, and some people would say that's pretty slow. I think it's actually kind of fast, but...
Yeah, 4 months, that seems pretty
quick. Well, 4 months was really fast.
Yes.
Nine months,
that's about average, I think, from just
now
listening.
Now it's average. I'm hearing people say it's average, but to me it feels fast. I don't know.
Yeah, that's about average.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just because, I don't really know why the reason, but, you know, like Stephen James, he goes, I had to cut back. I couldn't do that many. He goes, people were like, do this and this. He goes, look, I'm going to do one YA, which is kind of easier for him to do. He goes, and then just one other. He goes, I can't do those fast. You just don't want to throw something out there and just have it out there. You always want to put your best foot forward.
I know, guys. Excuse me. I know authors who are writing 3 books a year, and they're just fast. They have ideas, and you know they write in the airport, they write in the coffee shop, wherever mm-hmm. they are. They bring a laptop and they write. I have kids and I have other things going on where I can't always just have a laptop at my disposal. And if I did, I think it would help.
Mm-hmm.
But I also tend to be kind of the person who wants to be in front of my station, my little work area. I tend to
your
be
comfort
that,
zone.
Yeah, I wake up at 6 or 7, have my coffee, sit down and write. I have my routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the really fast writers are able to write without that routine. They're able to write anywhere, which I kind of admire. I'm going to try and work on expanding my abilities in that regard.
Well, we know you're going to get to a book signing, so let's just figure out. So where's the best place people can find everything out about what you're doing?
All right, go to my website, www.jamiefrabelletti.com. It's just my name, jamiefrabelletti.com. Everything should be on there. I'm going to be revamping the site in August, but it will be up most of the time, I think, during the revamp.
And then besides Thriller Fest, are you doing anything else for the rest of the year, conference-wise, where people can find you?
Yes, I will be teaching a class at Story Studio on thriller writing in Chicago. And in October, I have 2 signings in Chicago, and then I also go to BoucherCon, which I believe is
in Raleigh, yes.
North Carolina this year.
Nice. Well, Jamie, we want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day, and we'll catch you on, you know, doing
it. Great to see
All
you.
Right,
thank
bye-bye.
You.
So we're here with Robert Wilson, author, and we're at Thriller Fest. First one for Robert. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you.
So this is your first Thriller Fest, and we just got here, so you really haven't had a chance to kind of go around and see everything, but you've been to other several conferences. What is the one thing, as an author, when you come to these conferences that you hope to get out of it, and what are maybe some surprises that you do get out of them?
Well, I think you're always looking to meet people, and the great thing about conferences is that you never know the kind of people you're going to meet. You know, are they going to be people, you know, other writers? It's always great to meet other writers because, you know, the profession is a very lonely profession. You spend your whole day sitting on your own.
That's true.
Dragging stuff out of your head, you know. And so it's great to see other people and, you know, and compare your lonely experiences together.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, then there are all these other guys, you know, in bookshops, you know, in the media, in all sort of aspects of publishing, and it's great to catch up with those sort of guys as well, and on a sort of fairly relaxed footing. You're not
mm-hmm.
you're not necessarily sort of doing business. You're just sort of sitting around bumping into people, and that I think is the great thing about it.
And some conferences are more fan-oriented, like a BoucherCon. You have a lot more fans that kind of come. Thriller Fest is more of a networking, professional conference where you're not going to have as many fans. Do you change your mindset when you kind of go to those things, knowing when you go into them, this is kind of what I'm going to get out of it and what I'm going to have to do when I go to these things?
I suppose, you know, because things like sort of BoucherCon, I mean, and my first sort of vision of Thriller Fest, so these are much, much bigger conferences than you'll get in the UK,
mm-hmm.
in Europe. In the UK, they just tend to be, you know, smaller hotels, tighter communities.
But Harrogate is a big one. Harrogate is a big one, right? Would that be like the BoucherCon of UK?
It is in terms of its importance.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say in terms of its size, in terms of the number of people who are going there. And so you don't feel as if it's sort of completely massive, and you're going to be lucky to meet sort of, you know, 5% of the people there.
Mm-hmm.
In Harrogate, you can go just hang around in the bar, and you'll meet pretty much everybody.
You can do that here too. Stay till 1 o'clock, and you'll meet them all. And now, what's the difference? Now, your latest book, and it's. The one thing that's interesting, because Peter James is a friend of ours, and he's very big, of course, in Europe.
Hmm.
The United States, he doesn't do very well. I mean, he's like, I come over here and I can't, you know, sign a book. Over there, he goes, he signs them all the time. Do you kind of see, and we don't really figure out why, but do you see a difference in American readers to European readers with your work and how those things maybe kind of translate in sales? Or in attendance, you know, not really maybe sales, but in popularity.
Well, I mean, I suppose my big introduction to America was with my book, A Small Death in Lisbon.
Okay.
And that was a World War II story. And I think that is huge with American readers, because that's, you know, the last time there was a major American intervention in the world where it was extremely successful. And I think a lot of American readers are very interested, almost obsessed.
Because it's a world event.
Because it's a world event. America made an absolutely massive difference to that world event. And so if you can find a way of writing about something like that, which is a little bit more interesting, different, then I think you were going to pick up some American readers. Because I was living in Portugal, I happened to find a story that was about, you know, I'll just tell you very briefly about, you know, Hitler, when he invaded Russia, he cut himself off from one major element that he needed that was mined in China and was coming through to him from Russia, and it's called wolfram. And the wolfram was used as a hardener for steel.
Oh.
And because he was blitzkrieg, it was all about tanks and armor-piercing shells, they needed that alloy, wolfram, to harden the steel. And once he invaded Russia, he cut himself off from that. Hmm. So the only decent supply of wolfram, there's a little bit in Sweden, but the big supply was in Portugal. And so the whole of German, there was a huge sort of interest in developing relationships with Portugal. Salazar, who was a right-wing dictator, he didn't want to join in the war. He wanted to keep out of it. The Brits have the longest-standing treaty in the world ever with the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this incredibly difficult situation with the Axis putting huge pressure on Salazar, the Allies saying, "Remember us, we've been mates since 1386. I've never even heard of that
story. I had no idea. That is fascinating.
Well, that's a small death in Lisbon for you.
Yeah.
I think that did, you know, do good business in the US,
mm-hmm.
purely because it was a corner of World War II that very, very few people had heard of.
And was that something that you just stumbled upon? Was that a story you kind of stumbled upon, or did you go out researching it, or did it just happen?
Well, I was looking at Nazi gold. This was back in the 1990s, and mm-hmm. Nazi gold was a huge thing. You know, what had happened with it? Where did it go? You know, they kind of knew that Nazi gold had sort of found its way out through Spain and Portugal and ended up in South America. And I was looking at that and thinking, yeah, this is interesting. But oddly enough, you would expect gold to be sort of, you know, have some sort of emotional draw, but there wasn't really very much to it. And I was thinking, what can I say about gold? Not very much. And so then my late wife was with me in the library, and I said, why don't you just go and have a look? I've got to do something else. Why don't you just sort of cross-reference gold with Portugal and, you know, just see what sort of happens? And she came back after about half an hour and said, I found this very interesting thing. It said the Portuguese gold reserves went up sevenfold during World War II because of wolfram. I said, do you know what wolfram is? She said, no idea. Let's go and find out.
And there it is.
And there it was, you know.
So now, talk about your latest book.
Okay, You Will Never Find Me. That's the one that's come out.
Yeah?
Because I'm a year ahead in the UK.
Oh, that's right. This freaking UK to United States thing. Peter does the same thing. He's like, yeah, my book was out 8 months ago, and it comes out in October here, and it's like, So what's the one that was in the UK? Because with Amazon, people can go onto the UK site and kind of find things to do.
Well,
but what's the one? So that's the one that just came out in the United States.
The one that came out in the United States is You Will Never Find Me, and that's the second book in the Charles Boxer series. Charles Boxer is the kidnap consultant and finder of missing persons.
Okay.
His debut was in a novel called Capital Punishment, which was published over here by Harcourt, and I changed to Europa. And Europa publish.
Okay.
You Will Never Find Me. And they will publish the book that's just come out in the UK, which is called Stealing People.
And that'll be the one in the UK first.
That came out in the UK last month, and that'll come out next year.
So You Can Never Find Me is the one that the states can get right now. That would be the latest one that they can get. So what is that one? What did that one entail? What did you do to your character? Why did you mess him up?
Well, why did I mess him up? We always mess him up. So.
You got to mess him up and then fix him.
Yeah, I mean, I had here was the interesting thing about capital punishment was it was a big story about the sort of huge sort of events, the way in which London, in the same way that New York has huge reach around the world, London has huge reach around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the thing about London as well is that it's made up of people, and
right.
People have lives, and those lives are very messy. And so what I wanted to show with You Will Never Find Me is those messy lives.
Okay.
And so, you know, Charles Boxer, my hero, he's been having a lot of trouble with his daughter. His daughter's a 17-year-old, just over 17-year-old girl. She's the mother is Detective Inspector Mercy Dangwin. She works on the kidnap unit with the Metropolitan Police. And she and her daughter live together, but they really, really don't get on. And she runs away from home.
Mm.
And the note she leaves at the end, the last line of the note is, "You will never find me." That's the challenge she drops down to Charles Boxer and her mother. She knows that their professional interest will be unable to.
How emotional is that?
And so that's the thump of the book.
Yeah.
And very quickly, because of their connections, they find out through the border police that she's gone to Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Boxer happens to speak very good Spanish, so he goes out to Madrid and starts working to find out where she's ended up.
And the game begins.
And the game begins.
Now,
and the game begins with a body.
Always with a body, isn't it?
Yeah.
So now, for American fans just finding out about your character, Charles Boxer, who is he?
Well, Charles Boxer is a kidnap consultant. He's the biggest life event for Charles Boxer is when he was 7 years old. His father disappeared and has never been seen again. And he had a very, very strong, close relationship with his father.
Does he know what happened to him? Did his father leave on his own, or was he taken?
He knows that the police wanted to talk to him about the murder of his mother's business partner. His mother is a commercials producer.
Okay.
And her business partner was the director in that commercials production company. And he was murdered. The police want to talk to Charles Boxer's father, and before they get the opportunity, he disappears out of his life. And Boxer, as a 7-year-old, you know, he's got this very, very close relationship with his father. You know, they do a lot of stuff together. His father was a judo champion, and so they used to do judo together, and then suddenly this guy goes out of his life, and he just can't leave it alone. When he's 14, he disappears. He runs away from school, cycles down to Spain to try and find his father, because he knows that
he's tormented.
He knows that you know, British criminals end up in Spain, you know, but he's eventually pulled back. And then when he's 18, he runs away from school, and this time he goes all the way to West Africa, and he tries to find his father in West Africa. And he doesn't find his father, because it's another thing he's heard and he gets obsessed about, is that people try to lose themselves in West Africa, and you think he'll be able to find his dad there. He doesn't find her, but he finds Mercy. And Mercy, he brings her back, and they have this partnership, and the product is Amy, you know. He goes into the army, and he fights in the Gulf War, and then he decides that maybe he should have a go at homicide, and one of the reasons he wants to have a go at homicide is he's got to find out about his father. He wants to, there's something in there, you know, he's determined to prove his father's innocence.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear very much about what happened to him in the Metropolitan Police. All we know is that he threw it in.
Okay.
He decided, this isn't for me. I mean, his bullshit line is, you know, this is all about history, and I'm not interested in history.
Right.
History's never done me any favors. So I'm going into the kidnap consultancy business. And because he's got very good contacts from the army, and that's mainly where kidnap consultants are recruited from.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're mainly ex-army guys.
And you said something interesting. Is it true most British criminals end up in Spain? Is that...
It was just a popular place for them to go. In
really?
It started off in the 1970s, 80s, 90s.
Wow.
But the great thing about it, we see, was that they could launder their money down there.
Okay.
So there was a huge construction industry down in because they were building lots of tourist developments down there. And so it was easy to push your money through these tourist developments and clean it.
Gotcha. Huh. So it sounds like he's still kind of tormented by the stuff that has happened. He is very emotionally driven in his work. Is that something that you wanted to, when you were creating him, that was something that you wanted to make sure that the reader understood, that his emotions were kind of a driving force, the tormenting part of him was a driving force? I mean, heck, you know, leaving at 14 and doing his thing, I mean, he just couldn't keep it going. Was that...
I mean, the interesting thing about kidnap consultants, which is a bit of a nightmare for writers, of course, of thrillers, is that the job of a kidnap consultant is to go into a situation, a very, very emotional situation,
mm-hmm.
normally a family member.
Regardless of where it is in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Normally, it's, you know, somebody has been stolen, you know,
yeah.
somebody has been taken, and it doesn't matter whether you're a crew member on a ship in, you know, just off the Somalia coast, or whether you're, you know, somebody's daughter. You know, that is a very, very emotional situation. And the first, the most important job for a kidnap consultant is introduce calm, is to remove all potential for drama. And that, of course, is a nightmare for the thriller writer, because all you want
is drama.
Is drama, you know.
It's probably tough for Charles, because he's been in this situation. He knows, but he also knows the other side.
I mean, that's what's driving him all the time.
Yeah.
And what he says is, I'm not interested in history because history didn't make me famous. What I'd want to do is be where it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important. Is and being where it matters is, because he in rescuing somebody from a kidnap gang is, you know, it's a massive relief to the parents, but he gets an absolutely enormous kick out of it. But here's the rub. He's left his big job. He had a job with a company called Global Risk Management. And they are a salary. They have salaried kidnap consultants, but because of the problem that's how seriously they run. It's actually based. Global Risk Management is based on a company in London.
A for-profit organization for kidnapping. Interesting.
No, for rescuing.
Right.
Yeah. Not.
Well, I mean, but they have paid things. So there's kind of.
So what they're doing is because they're in London, because in London is near the Lloyd's insurance market. And it's actually a company.
And are they law enforcement?
They're not law enforcement. No, they're a private security company. I think
that
you call them
law enforcement. Maybe private eyes.
No, I mean, so for instance, if you have a private military security company, which is what I think they're called here.
Okay.
What they do is they do things like organized security in Afghanistan.
Private, like a private security detail force or something.
Yeah,
exactly. For kidnapping.
So what these guys do is if you have insurance with Lloyd's, you know, and a member of your staff gets kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Lloyd's. Lloyd's contact, you know, people like this company.
Okay.
And they come, and they send a kidnap consultant to. And the interesting thing about kidnap consultants is they never ever deal directly with the kidnappers. What they do is they create the environment where the kidnappers. Plans are frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if a family member has been taken, they create a crisis management committee, and you will get a lawyer, a close family friend, and the whole idea of this is to keep the parents away from the kidnappers. And so the crisis management committee will talk to the kidnappers under the guidance of the kidnap consultant, and they will negotiate with the kidnap gang. And so that is how you how you take the drama out of a situation.
Now, in today's day and age, you rarely hear in the news about a kidnapping for ransom. I don't know if I can ever remember really one. I mean, of course, the Lindbergh baby and some of the other ones, very, very high profile. Of course, when somebody gets kidnapped, it's not really for ransom, especially like in the States. It's for much other reasons. Is there a reason why? Because you know it happens. I mean, you know, you have several people like in New York, L.A. I mean, you got a lot of money. People are going to do those kinds of things. Is there a reason why these things aren't covered as much as maybe they should be? Because they are real. But I don't, and maybe they're more real in Europe. I don't really see that, you know, the news maybe over there besides watching like Al Jazeera or BBC and hearing the international news. But is there a reason maybe why?
You don't hear very much about them because it's quite difficult to prosecute kidnap gangs. Especially if they get the ransom.
And is that,
you know, they disappear.
And is the ransom normally paid and then they get the product back? What's the more of the percentage? Because I would have no idea. I'd be fascinated. I don't think really anybody has any idea. Do you pay the ransom, you get the person back, and then it's all good?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, there's been some mysterious goings on. I mean, sure. For instance, I think the Americans have said very definitely, we do not pay kidnap gangs. They've actually made that statement. And the French, I think, as you probably will probably remember, mm-hmm. they've been, you know, less committed on that front. And certainly with some of these, the Somali pirates.
Oh, yeah.
There have been some payments made.
It's a risk, yeah.
There have been some payments made. And they have received the hostages back. But you see, this is where my character, Charles Boxer, comes in because it's quite difficult to prosecute kidnap gangs. And because...
So he's not out for prosecution.
Because Charles Boxer has lost... He used to be with this amazing company... Now he's left the structure of that company because he realizes he's got to spend a bit more time with his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
In losing that structure and the camaraderie of colleagues, he's suddenly become a little bit unstable. And one of the things that he's started to offer his clients. It's because he's now operating freelance
mm-hmm.
through another guy who runs a private security company that is a little, you know, that has a little dark side to it.
Mm-hmm.
He is prepared to go after the kidnap gang and sort them out. And he, on a few occasions, he has done this. And he's been rewarded for it. And the way in which he's rewarded is he takes donations and puts it into his foundation, which is called the Lost Foundation, and that's for finding missing persons. And the reason he set up that foundation is because of his missing father.
Ah, interesting. Now, when you are writing such an emotional subject, and like you said, I mean, there's some dark parts to it. I mean, it's, of course, parents' worst nightmare. Child gets kidnapped. It's almost, I guess, some people say kidnapping is worse than death because you don't have a closure. You don't know what's going on, and you don't know how things are out there. Is there a subject matter, though, within that even you decide, you know what, it's a little too close, and I'm not going to maybe go there as a writer and not maybe touch on it?
I think, I mean, I'd find it very difficult to write about small children.
Okay.
I think I'd find that hard going,
mm-hmm.
I think. Interesting enough, in the book that's just come out in the UK, which is Stealing People, there are some smaller children who are kidnapped.
Because the dark side, of course, is the human sex trafficking. I mean, let's face it, that's the big thing in the news, is people are being kidnapped. I mean, you know, the movie Taken with Liam Neeson, in Europe, with the Bulgarians or Algerians, I forget which one, you know, they took the daughter and it was for the human sex trafficking kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part, and that's the really dark side, of course, what goes on. Is that kind of one of the...
I mean, there's certainly, you know, the famous, I don't know whether you heard about this in the United States, with the McCann girl.
I think so.
Madeleine McCann was a little girl who was at a holiday resort with her parents, down in Portugal, in the Algarve, in the south of Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents went out for just down the road to have a quick bite to eat.
Mm-hmm.
They came back and she'd gone.
That I
disappeared, and she was 5-6 years old, something like that. And there was an absolutely sort of colossal investigation because the father was a doctor. Both parents were doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have that sort of middle class sort of clout that they can pull, you know, people together. They're intelligent, they're articulate, and they can get the coverage that perhaps other people can't get, because small children, I'm afraid, are kidnapped all the time.
Yes.
But that is the most, I think, the most terrible situation with still to this day. And you know, this girl, if she's still alive.
How long ago was that?
This is 10 years ago now.
Oh, gosh. That means, see, and that's the thing. The parents have to be just going absolutely ballistic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But they're still fighting the fight. They're still fighting. I mean, you can never, ever give up, can you?
No. As a parent, you have to get, you know, you need a closure. And that's why I said sometimes it's almost, they almost feel, not. I guess, relief might be a bad word, but if they do find her, you know, gone, but they have a closure, then at least they have a closure.
Hmm.
Of course, you want her back and healthy, and I mean, now she's going to be, 15 at this time, so we don't even know what she probably looks like at this time, and you can have renders and things like that, but that's just absolutely fascinating. I mean, I have four children. I couldn't imagine if they were one of them were taken at 5 years old. And that's a huge emotional pull of the book, and that's where, you know, you have to bring that emotion as a writer into it to where the reader's probably going to cry. I mean, you can have readers crying, saying, I feel so bad.
Mm.
And do you get those kind of emails? Do you get those from fans, you know, writing you saying, you just touched me in those kinds of ways.
In this particular book, and You Will Never Find Me, I'm not going to reveal to you what actually happens, but there is something...
There's a motive for what happened.
There is something absolutely appallingly shocking that happens very early on in the book. I mean, that really knocks readers completely off their chair, and they just...
To where they almost stop and say, okay, now I got to take a break before I can pick it back up again.
They just cannot believe it, you know?
Wow.
And all I can tell you is you just got to keep reading.
It's in the first 50 pages.
It's in the first 50 pages. You'll be knocked off your chair. And then you've got to pick yourself up, dust yourself down, keep reading.
So... We're getting down to the end, so I want to be able to let everybody know, where's the best place for them to find you and contact you if they have any questions or, you know, just to find out more information about you? Like you said, your book's kind of out in the UK first, then you're about 10 months later in the United States time. So it's almost like, you know, UK authors, the movie goes to film and you wait for it to come on Netflix before you finally get it. So where's the best place for them to contact you for readers in the United States?
Well, I think if you go to my website. You
what
know,
is that?
www.robert-wilson.eu.
Okay.
And
are you on social media? You do that?
And I'm on social media as well, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got, Twitter and Facebook and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm easily discoverable.
And you have a lot of content, a lot of things of that nature?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so facebook.com/RobertWilsonAuthor. Twitter @ Rob Wilson author, Rob Wilson writer, my fault.
Mm.
Fascinating stuff, Robert. Mm. I mean, just, we could go on for, you know, days talking about these kinds of things, and that's the fascination of the writer and the character and the creation. So one more quick question, though, because I'm always fascinated about this, is, was it the character that got you involved, or was it the subject matter of the kidnapping that got you to start writing Charles Boxer series?
Well, that's an interesting question, because originally I'd come up with a synopsis for a book set in China.
Uh-huh.
And when I went to my agent with that, and he had an editor come along with him, and I pitched the book to him, and he said, this is an absolutely brilliant idea,
mm-hmm.
but nobody's ready to read about China.
And really?
I said, what do you mean? And he said, in the UK, UK readers, they don't want to know about China. And I said, that's ridiculous, you know, I mean, don't be crazy. And I went off and I did a whole load of research, I mean, not sort of, professional research, but just talking to people on Facebook, talking to people on the internet, talking to my friends, other writers, and I was stunned. The number of people who said, I'm not interested in China, I'm not interested in reading about China, China is too alien to me.
Too communist, maybe a little too much? And just
I think it's just that it's such an alien culture.
It is.
But they
do that on their purpose. They do that on purpose on their own. They like to keep themselves isolated, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think they like a lot of information coming out on purpose, and they filter what comes out. And I think some people think that it's what comes out is a lie, because they know that the government's feeding that stuff out instead of more people or more news organizations being able to speak freely about what goes on. So I think a lot of people feel jaded, maybe. And so maybe that's what they feel. I don't know. That's just a theory.
But my intention was actually to write about China back in the 1930s. You know, this was before Mao Zedong and all that sort of thing.
Oh.
But anyway, what they said was, you know, shelve it again.
Yeah.
I shelved it. And so then I started thinking, what am I going to do? And then I started thinking about private security companies.
Mm.
And then I started thinking, I've written books set in West Africa, set in Portugal, set in Spain. Actually, what I really want to do is write a book set in London, because I'm...
From London?
From London. And I,
go Tottenham!
And I...
That's all it takes. You say the wrong sports team to a UK guy, and they're getting you. Yeah, I'm a Tottenham fan. White Hart Lane, baby.
Well... Yes, I could have said I'm Arsenal, but in fact I'm not.
But I love Ozil. I'm a huge German fan. I love Ozil.
I'm Chelsea because of Zé Mourinho.
Okay, see, and that's all it takes. You can go now. We've gone for hours on soccer too because I love the Premier League. But Robert, we want to thank you so much. It's
been
fabulous to talk with you. So have fun at the conference. Good luck, and can't wait to see what's next.
Thanks very much. It's been great.
All right.
Good night, everybody.
Have a good one.